From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll talk with one of the people who shaped NPR and its signature show, All Things Considered, about the formative days of the network.
Later, our How Did You Do That podcast examines the business of investing in business.
It's almost a rule. If you're investing in early stage companies, the trick is not to give them any more money than they need and to keep them focused on the short term and not worry about the long term.
And cartoonist and Milwaukee native Paul Noth says Charles Schulz's Peanuts was like the gateway drug for him and others in his generation.
I think it's pretty common among cartoonists of our generation to, because it was an entire world you could just get lost in. You know, it was like an epic novel, you know, and, you know, incredibly funny, very simple, too.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 paved the way for the creation of National Public Radio. It formally began on February 26, 1970. NPR has come a long way since its early days, moving from a time when it was seen as alternative and experimental to the point today where it boasts the most listened to morning radio show in the United States.
Bill Siemering knows the early days well. The Wisconsin native was one of the guiding forces behind National Public Radio, serving on its founding board. And he later helped develop signature shows such as All Things Considered and Fresh Air. After decades in public radio, he shifted his focus to radio in the developing world, earning a MacArthur Fellowship in his efforts. Siemering was in Milwaukee not long ago, and he joined us in the studio to share some radio history. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be with you, Mitch.
Why was radio first important to you?
It was first important to me as a first grader going to a two-room country school outside of Madison, Wisconsin, and listening to the Wisconsin School of the Air. So I learned science, social studies, nature studies, music, art, all by radio. From that time on, I've been fascinated by radio.
Do you still have the memory of those voices coming through the radio?
I do. Yeah. I do. And interestingly enough, the teacher would always have a manual and know what science things she had to have set up or art things. So a number of them were women, which I realized later was not common in broadcasting. It was a wonderful way to enrich education in a country school.
Right. The country school never would have had access to all these kinds of lessons otherwise.
Exactly. I mean, the teacher was teaching three grades. Which is enough.
Well, how did that work? At a certain time during the day, the teacher would just turn on the radio.
Right. Twice a day, she'd turn it on, and she knew what was coming, and we would listen attentively and do whatever we were told to do.
So when you think about that time and how radio shaped you as a first grader, what of that time still shapes the way you see how radio meets its listeners today?
Well, simply put, I guess every time I turn on public radio, I learn something new. I always think of radio as a source of information and of extraordinary intimacy at times. It's the most intimate medium, really, because it's a human voice. And people are free to engage with a host and open up in ways that they wouldn't in any other way. Television is not conducive to that with the lights and cameras and everything going on. So radio and the listeners are creating the images. Listeners are imagining what you and I look like now. And it's nothing like what we do look like, of course.
Well, and it's funny, even today, for as long as I've been in radio, and I imagine maybe the same for you, I still, to this day, get the images wrong in my head.
Uh-huh. Right. But I think that's part of the ownership the listener has with us, that they're imagining this.
And it goes without saying that we are both tall and very handsome. So there was obviously a little bit of time between first grade and the early days of NPR. What was your connection to radio between that point and the point that you arrived in Washington?
So I worked at I worked my way through the University of Wisconsin in Madison at WHA, at Wisconsin Public Radio. First as an engineer, editing tape and so on, and then on air as an announcer, interviewer, reporter, that kind of thing. And then I was in the Army. I taught school up in Eagle River, Wisconsin, and I was teaching school and working summers at WHA. And they got a call from somebody I'd had as a professor at Wisconsin that wanted somebody that had experience in radio and student personnel. And I happened to have that combination because radio at SUNY Buffalo was a club, a student club. It was off the air in the summers. They'd go on the air 5 in the afternoon. And so it wasn't a proper station. Anyway, I took that opportunity because it was a wonderful chance to develop something. He gave me a lot of freedom, not much money, but we had a lot of freedom to experiment. And that's the way I used that station.
You created – this is the station where you created This Is Radio, is that right?
Yes, which became Fresh Air. We established a storefront studio in the heart of the black community. This was during the 60s, and I was very keenly aware of the need for hearing from voices that aren't heard on radio. And so that all informed me in writing the mission statement for NPR that emphasizes the importance of – celebrating difference and treating people with positive regard and to talk with many voices and many accents because that's what America's about. And I wrote that because I was trying to make the transition from educational radio to public. And the words mean something. And by public, that means everybody. And so I was trying to differentiate it from commercial radio, from educational radio, from PBS that was already on the air, and to capitalize on the unique strengths of radio as a medium and to reflect the issues of the day, if you will.
Well, and it's interesting. We're having this conversation in 2018. I would imagine that in the mid-late 60s, there were still plenty of people already at that point who were saying the days of radio are numbered.
Yes, yes. They were. And... And people would say, "Oh, you work in just radio?" I mean, people never say that to a print journalist. Oh, you're just print? I remember there was some public broadcasting event. There were television people and radio. And it was before we were on air with NPR. And the TV guys were going through some clippings from the New York Times. They said, "So, Seymour, what do you think the New York Times is going to say about you next in a year from now?" I said, "We're not programming for the New York Times." I was being a bit smart aleck about it, but I was, you know, I mean, we have just a very different orientation.
Well, and the irony is that today the New York Times is producing audio programs.
Exactly. Because this is the age of audio. When the New York Times does that, and when the New Yorker, which is kind of the preeminent print publication we think of, as the New Yorker Radio Hour, we know that radio is now, you know, elevated to a wonderful place.
Well, and I've noticed this phenomenon that I'm curious to have you reflect on because I think this is kind of what we're talking about. I mean, we're in this kind of podcast-intensive media universe today, and, you know, there are some really good ones out there, and there are some nightmarishly bad ones and plenty in between. But I can't help but think when I listen to them that this feels a lot like an earlier time in radio, that people are wanting to make them for the same reasons that you and I got into radio, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Right. And it's this wonderful storytelling. And with the volume of news that we have to deal with and you're dealing with, there's not the place for these more quiet, reflective conversations.
Where does your work in developing nations come in? What do you see as the relative importance of radio and audio in those places compared to, you know, what we kind of have the luxury of using audio for here?
Yes. So I'd worked, after I was been working in public radio, I worked with the Open Society Foundation for 10 years, and they worked in Eastern Europe and Africa and Mongolia. The idea there behind their work was, look, these people have not had democracy for 70 years. They need like a Marshall Plan. And so George Soros set up foundations all over in these countries to talk about constitutions, media, law, and health, education, the basics, you know. So that's how I started my work overseas. And I went to South Africa first in 1993. This was the year before the elections, because I met with people that were interested in reforming the state broadcasting, South African Broadcasting Corporation, which was like a BBC.
Right. But at that point, it was probably just a mouthpiece for the government.
Right. And so they wanted to reform that so people could be informed about the election. And there were others interested in community radio. And interestingly enough, when the government formed their licensing authority, they only licensed community stations because they thought in the first year, because they thought they would best serve the interests of democracy, because they speak in local languages. And sometimes stations broadcast in three or more local languages. And they reflect the issues and concerns of the people, just as you do this here in Milwaukee. You're out in the community talking to people, finding out what their needs are and interests are.
How far along on the continuum were they in being able to do that?
Well, it's in terms of the production and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we provide, in some cases, we usually always are working now with existing stations. One of our African trainers, Martha Zulu, begins her workshops by saying, "Why are we here to focus?" And it's a wonderful question. I also hear that is, why are we here on Earth? What's the purpose? What's the meaning of life? But it helps focus a station. Like, you know, are we just here to play our favorite music, or do we have a more serious purpose? So we now enrich the programming on climate change, on youth health, women's health, things like this. And we do this by always having African trainers. So we work with existing stations. We bring them together. We'll have experts talking about climate change in that country or a health issue. We give them a digital recorder and mic, and they go out and have a field exercise and then critique it so they polish their skills. Then we send them weekly bulletins on a topic, like how do you store water for drought or on malaria youth-friendly health services. And they, again, these come from there. It has the problem statement on one side and solutions and production tips on the other. So they can go out with little experience and do these.
When you do something like that, do you get a different sense of professional or self-satisfaction in what you're able to do versus, you know, shaping the various shows that you shaped in this country?
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful to see them take the initiative. It's a very different relationship. I just go over there on the first workshop sometimes. I've got a colleague that does the implementation and so on. But we have excellent African trainers, and they then go and mentor. They visit each station and mentor. But it's so satisfying to see the results, where you change attitudes about talking about safe sex, for example. It's wonderful to see that impact of radio on people's lives.
No one there is saying, oh, you're just in radio.
No.
Is there a similar spirit in that kind of work when you experience a station at that stage to what the spirit was like in those kind of formative years for public radio?
There is some parallel to that. It's such a different environment, though. But they're using this wonderful, imaginative, creative medium. I mean, they produce little radio plays. I mean, no one's taught them that, but they do that with sound effects and everything. And that's what's so encouraging to see them taking this idea and making it their own.
When you think about where public radio was in the late 60s, mm-hmm. early 70s, and you're developing, you know, All Things Considered in 1971, when you look at the soul of NPR from those days, what parts of that soul are most still in evidence in 2018? I mean, the building obviously looks mm-hmm. a lot different.
Yes. I think it really reflects some of those core values. I mean, that we had in, because I think this is what you do with Lake Effect. The editorial attitude would be that of inquiry, curiosity, concern for the quality of life, critical, problem-solving, and life-loving. So I think that's what you do with Lake Effect.
Life-loving is an underrated part of the equation, too.
Yeah. Then I said, philosophically, time is measured by the intensity of experience. Waiting for a bus and walking through an art gallery may occupy the same time duration, but not the same time experience. Listeners should feel that the time spent with NPR was among their most rewarding in media contact. National Public Radio will not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience.
Do you remember your surroundings when you wrote those words?
I wrote that on my dining room table in Buffalo, New York. But I'd been thinking about these things for a long time and trying to make the case for radio. As we began talking about how radio was called the hidden medium, there was some folks in television tried to keep radio out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because we were such an embarrassment, they thought. And, of course, we take money away from television, which is more important. So this was aspirational, but I thought it was also practical. So it was a wonderful opportunity. Now, a lot of stations, I think, thought we're going to be like the big guys. It's going to sound like CBS and NBC, and it didn't. So there was the first meeting of the public radio managers. I think it was about 2 weeks after we were live. And it was kind of a hostile crowd, I must say. They said, who are these people? They wanted to sound like, you know, and I said, so we have a conversational style, you know.
They wanted to sound like Douglas Edwards.
Exactly. Right. They were very suspicious of, we were using music in the program. We had arts features, of course, because we were considering all things.
Well, and just calling it All Things Considered had to have been a radical change from the kinds of names that other news programs had,
right.
You know, the CBS Evening News.
Right. You know, and it was hard. I mean, there were some programs where, you know, there'd be a brilliant piece and something, gosh, awful that we'd be embarrassed about because we had a very small staff gathered together, some more experience than others. It took a while to gel as a unit. It was in beta form for a while. However, a program that was aired in October of 1972 won a Peabody Award. So we did get it together.
Well, and it is something when a document that you wrote at your dining room table in Buffalo, New York in 1970 still holds the same relevance and importance that it did 48 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Well, Bill Siemering, it has been a real honor and a delight to chat with you. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed being with you, Mitch, very much.
Wisconsin native Bill Siemering was on the founding board of National Public Radio. He worked at NPR, WBFO in Buffalo, Minnesota Public Radio, and WHYY in Philadelphia. Today, he's a senior fellow with the Wincote Foundation, also in Philadelphia.
A quick break now, and then our How Did You Do That feature focuses on a pioneer in Wisconsin's venture capital world, the business of investing in business, when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's time for our monthly segment on entrepreneurship and innovation.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is the director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keene.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors. And this is How Did You Do That? A show about how and why successful entrepreneurs succeeded.
Our guest today is John Burns, non-executive chairman of Mason Wells Private Equity and chairman of the Milwaukee Institute.
In the spirit of full disclosure, I run the Milwaukee Institute, so John is my chairman. John spent decades building successful companies, his own and others. After running the private equity group at Marshall and Ilsley Bank for 15 years, he managed its spin-out into a new private equity firm. Under John's leadership, Mason Wells raised three committed capital funds, the last reaching $525 million.
Since his retirement, the Mason Wells team under the leadership of Tom Smith has gone on to raise a $615 million fund. As he built Mason Wells, John built a very successful track record, helping grow more than 75 portfolio companies in dozens of industries.
John, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thank you.
So, John, you know, your vantage point is pretty unique. There are not that many people around here that have your breadth of experience investing in companies, private companies all the time, right, that are pretty variable. And I would think that the question many of our entrepreneur listeners are going to have is, if you're out looking to raise money for a company, what's the first thing you should be aware of in terms of the mind of the guys doing the investing?
Well, I think most investors, whether they're large or small, are looking for a business to invest in. And what that means is that there needs to be a business model, and a business model consists of a product or service and a customer who's willing to pay for it. And there has to be more than one. And hopefully there's more than one product and there's more than one customer, and that creates a business model of repeat business and growth and profit. And that is what defines a business in very simple terms. And too often, entrepreneurs who are seeking money spend all their time talking about the market and the opportunity they see and not enough about how they're going to make money supplying a product or a service to that market.
John, does the size of the business require that managers change the way they run it? You know, is a small business fundamentally different from a large one in the way it's managed?
Yes. Small businesses, particularly entrepreneurial businesses, don't exist when they get started. So you're inventing a lot of the things. Whereas in an established business, there are typically more than one sources of income. There are more than one division. There's more than one division involved in creating the financial performance of the entity. So, yeah, large businesses are more complicated. You typically see more management of people as opposed to management of process, whereas in a small company, you have to invent and manage the process of creating the product or service, which is a different assignment.
So when you think about all the companies you've invested in, go back and tell us about the first one or the second one and what you found compelling and how that worked out.
Well, the first one we did was actually a buyout of GE's dental x-ray business. So that it was about a $4 million segment of GE at the time, and they divested of it because it was too small. And what we did is redesign the product line, move the manufacturing to a lower cost infrastructure from what GE had, and we expanded the product and the services and built it up from $4 million to about $75 million and eventually went public, which was fortunate because you never have to make up for a good start, you know, and it was a very successful deal. Some of the other things that we've worked on that have been interesting, we actually, our first startup was a thing called Office Solutions, a company over in Madison. Entrepreneur's name was Jan Eddy, and it was a desktop word processing that was in the market along with another product called WordPerfect. And eventually those two companies were overrun by Microsoft Word. But in those days, they were some of the early pioneers in the desktop word processing. It was in the early 80s. The interesting thing there is we gave them an investment of $500,000, Roger Ganser and I from Rogers from Madison. And they never put the money to use. 5 years later, they still had the money. And they were $5 million in revenue as opposed to WordPerfect that went during that same period from $4 million to $60 million. That was a real strange investment. We did well on it because we ultimately sold it, but they never really used the money, which was a funny thing.
John, you've talked to me often about technology, and I remember you telling me once about discovering you were 10 and you went to the library and figured out how you could find out about technology.
Well, when I was a kid, long before you were even born, I mean, the only way to learn about technology was to get Popular Science magazine or Popular Mechanics or Scientific American, and you had to send away for things. Today, it's so easy. If I could come back as a much younger man, I would spend my life differently. But it's amazing to me. Just go on the internet and ask it a question. You can get an entire college and postgraduate education on the internet today. What a fortunate thing for young kids. Everywhere, not only just in the States, but in India and in South America and in Africa, they can get an education right on the internet, right off their smartphone. It's unbelievable.
You've always viewed technology as an important component of a company?
Well, I think technology is a growth engine. I mean, if you look at business as a financial enterprise, it hasn't changed much. Accounting is still accounting. And what grows businesses is the evolution of the relationship between the core value that the company delivers to its customer and the application of technology to do that. And so things get better, faster, and cheaper because of technology. So you have to understand technology if you're going to grow a business.
You know, I just have to ask this since you threw it out there. You said if you were a younger man, you'd do things differently. What would you do differently?
I would have gone to San Francisco and started a business. Actually, when I was when I got out of law school, I went to Seattle because I was interested in trying to convince Boeing to build a fast train. I had this design for a fast train called couplers, and the whole idea was that it never stopped. Because if you look at the train industry, the big problem is it stops. I mean, in 1870, you could go from Chicago to San Francisco by train almost as fast as you could get there today by flying because it never stopped. It just got on the rail and went 100 miles an hour for 2 days, a day and a half, 2 days, and it got to San Francisco. Today, it'd take you 3 or 4 days to do that because it stops all the way. On the way. So anyway, I had this thing called couplers, and it was the idea was the main train would keep going, and then these cars would, when they go by a city, they'd come on and they'd put passengers on and take them off. And there was a local loop that you'd run. But, it didn't work. It's way ahead of its time, so to speak.
This might be a redundant question after that, but you were a commercial banker who was tapped to manage M&I's private equity effort, something you'd never done before. What gave you the confidence to do it?
Well, I think, all entrepreneurially motivated people don't know they can't do it, so that was sort of a given. But I think at the time, Marshall and Ilsley was much more entrepreneurial inside the four walls of the building than people realized. I mean, Dennis Kester was promoting the data center. Jeff Williams was building our international operations. I was setting up the Capital Group. So there was a lot of activity. And Jack Pulicker, who was chairman and CEO at the time, was a bigger risk taker than he was given credit for. In fact, when we started the organization, I told him I thought we should, start our own. I put a plan together and I went in to give it to him. And he asked his secretary to call Walter. And I said, who's Walter? And he just said, wait a minute. He gets Walter on the phone. He hands me the phone. And I said, hello. And I start talking to this guy. And Walter is Walter Aikman. And Walter Aikman, for those who don't know, was one of the founders of the National Venture Capital Association. And Walter tells me, well, I don't know what Jack has in mind, but if he wants me to do something, I'll be happy to do it because he was one of the early investors in my first fund. So I ended up spending 3 days in Boston with Walter Aikman asking him questions about how to do venture capital. And the next introduction I got was to a guy named Denny Phipps at Bessemer Securities, who was also one of the early venture capital guys. You know, and in those days, I was in the early 80s, 81, 82, and there were only about 20 people in the whole country that did venture capital at that time. And Jack knew two or three of them, so we had a real good start.
So, John, what are some of the common mistakes young entrepreneurs make when they're building their organizations and their management teams?
I see two mistakes almost every time. One is that they spend too much time focusing on the long-term strategy that I call the end game. When they're successful and they're crossing the finish line and they're a, you know, $75 or $100 million revenue company, they're profitable, they're either going public or they're raising more capital to grow even faster. And not enough time on the early startup where they're trying to get the first customer, the second customer, the first $500,000. The small stuff, the small steps, I call it getting out of the starting block. Instead of crossing the finish line, you got to figure out how to get out of the starting block. And so they don't spend enough time thinking about the obstacles and the challenges associated with doing that. And in that regard, they end up wasting money building a large management team. In fact, what I've noticed over the years is almost no matter how much money the investors give a startup, they will spend it in 18 months. And it's almost a rule. If you're investing in early stage companies, the trick is not to give them any more money than they need and to keep them focused on the short term and not worry about the long term. They have to get customers. There are some groups here in town that are starting to do that. I think Joe Kurgis at Generator does a good job of that.
What's the second mistake they make?
Well, I think they try to do too many things at once. They don't focus enough, as I said, on the near term. They waste money on large management teams that aren't necessary. Most small companies can be run by one good person who is on top of all the details. And as they grow, the next step is not to get a five-man management team, but to have one inside person, one outside person, and just split up the duties like that. You can grow to about 20 million, I found, with just an inside-outside person and not a full management team. You don't need a CFO to run a company that's spending $200,000 to $300,000 a year.
So, John, you were a commercial banker at M&I. How did the private equity arm get started at Marshall & Ailsley? Did you start it? Or?
Yes, I did start it, but the way it actually happened was that in the early 80s, there was an effort to form a venture capital fund in which the M&I bank was asked to invest, and Jack Pulicker called me and said, would you go to a meeting? And I said, about what? And he said, well, just go and you'll see when you get there. So I get to the meeting, and it's a meeting of about 15 people from the Milwaukee financial community, and the conversation was supporting a venture fund that everybody would contribute a certain amount to. And after the meeting, I went back, and Jack asked me what I thought of it, and I said, well, I think it's a good idea, but why don't we do it ourselves? We don't need anybody else to help us invest in small business. And he said, I agree with you. Put together a plan.
So John, in your experience, how do the best entrepreneurs deal with obstacles when they find them?
Good entrepreneurs overcome obstacles either by going around them or going over them. And it always involves some form of invention. We had a company in Ohio, for example, and it involved making composite materials. And they were running into lots of difficulty with the state DNR and the VOCs that they were putting into the atmosphere as part of this new process that they had developed. And the local DNR came in and said, we need to take all the air from your plant and put it through an incinerator. And the design that was being used at the time cost about $10 million to implement, and this small business couldn't possibly do that. So the entrepreneur put together a tiger team to look at the way to try to solve this problem, and what they came up with was a close capture system that took the VOCs right off the press where the item was being made and pulled it into a tube so that it didn't get into the full atmosphere of the plant. And that had several virtues. One, it had a much more concentrated level of the VOC in it so that when you put it into the incinerator, you didn't have to add propane or natural gas to create a fire. It just was concentrated enough already. All you had to do was ignite it. And so the cost of the solution went from $10 million down to $2 million. And that's the sort of thing where, you know, you just have to invent your way around problems and think outside the box, as they say.
John, as an investor in that company, would you say you maybe did a little prodding to be inventive on that solution?
Well, yeah, we were part of the team of people that did it. But at the end of the day, the management has to implement these things. We don't run companies. In fact, I like to say that if I have to manage you, I will fire you.
There you go, Kathleen. Take that to heart.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks, John.
Hey, thank you, John, and thanks for all you've done, and we sure appreciate having you here today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Suggest ideas for future episodes of How Did You Do That at WUWM.com.
And be sure and listen to our other podcasts at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
Milwaukee native Paul Noth draws cartoons for The New Yorker, but his latest project targets a much younger audience. We'll speak with him when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee native, cartoonist, animator, and author Paul Noth has reached a lot of different audiences in his career, from TV viewers of Conan O'Brien and Saturday Night Live to erudite print readers in the pages of The New Yorker and The Wall Street Journal, and now discerning middle-grade readers.
Noth's new book is the first in a trilogy. It's called How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. Noth was back in Wisconsin not long ago for a series of school visits, but he joined us in the studio as well. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your career path. How did you go? I gather you are a product of MPS?
Yes. I'm K through 12, MPS schools the entire time. I just visited my high school. I'm coming directly from there, from Rufus King High. Always interested in cartoons. That was a distraction. That wasn't actually my studies. I didn't think that I would, luck out enough to get to do that for a living. Loved writing too. Loved books and literature. And thinking I'd be a writer, I went to Emerson College in Boston after King. And there I pursued literary fiction for a while, but always loved to draw and, drew in my spare time, filled up notebooks with my cartoons.
What were the cartoons you were reading when you were young?
I loved Calvin and Hobbes. I loved Charles Schulz, Peanuts. I really had everything. I would scour every public library for every cartoon. Anything that was a cartoon, I was familiar with. My father, who was the film critic for the Journal and feature editor, he'd bring me home sometimes. Cartoon books would come across the feature desk, and he'd bring them home for me. And that was a great era for cartoon books. So I was familiar with The New Yorker. I was familiar with, it was a much bigger field in those days of, all the newspaper comics and stuff like that. And so, but my favorite was probably Charles Schulz, and then a little bit later, Calvin and Hobbes.
It's interesting. I remember interviewing Mo Willems years ago, and he talked about getting into cartooning thanks to Charles Schulz. And his thought was, thank heavens that Peanuts was so relatively simple to draw because he could draw his version of peanut strips when he was in fourth grade.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. I was doing third grade is exactly right. I was copying Peanuts and trying to perfect them. That's another thing. I know Mo, and that's another thing that we have in common is that I didn't realize that. But, I think it's pretty common among cartoonists of our generation because it was an entire world you could just get lost in. It was like an epic novel, incredibly funny, very simple, too.
You mentioned the idea that you were just in this, the world of cartoons was huge in those days. And I don't know exactly how old you are, but it seems like about the same era that I grew up in. When you go to a school today, you just came from Rufus King, you're going to Trowbridge in a little while, you're going to spend the day on Tuesday going to schools in Oconomowoc. Do you see, are kids immersed in cartoons the same way today that they were when you were a kid?
I think so. It's a different world. It's a digital world. You know, my question for them is not, have you heard of the New Yorker magazine? It's, have you heard of magazines? You know, there is a whole world of online cartoons. And, you know, a lot of what they think of as cartoons is animation, because that's much big. You know, I loved animation as a kid, but it was few and far between. You had to get up on Saturday morning. You had to get, you know, you had to let your mom turn on the TV after school to watch Bugs Bunny, which was really my favorite thing in the universe, were those Bugs Bunny cartoons. And so, you know, animation is much more widespread. But it's looking at my nieces and nephews, it's amazing how popular comics are right now, like comic books, anime. What isn't, you know, my favorite thing as a kid was the sort of short joke form. And that is, while it's, you know, in corners of the web, there's very good work being done. That's not as big as it was. But, you know, comics are huge, and anime is just huge, you know. So it's out there, just sort of in a slightly different form.
And I feel like I cut you off in your description of your career path, because the last we heard, you were working in literary fiction.
Yes.
And and then somehow you went from drawing in notebooks to actually doing it for a living.
Yeah, that was very surprising to me, because I was, you know, I was aware of the New Yorker from a very early age, and I sort of wrote it off at that early age too, because I knew, I watched it and I paid attention, and I knew not just by reputation, but I saw, you know, that it was always the same people, you know, and that it was really hard to break in, and so I never thought I would be a New Yorker cartoonist, and I was living in New York. And I began writing comedy, and there was a comedy show in New York called the Rejection Show, and it's everyone takes their rejected material, and you know, that you perform it or you show it. And so it was at that comedy show that I met Matt Diffie, a New Yorker cartoonist, and I showed him some of my cartoons, and he was like, you know, we're trying to bring in new people. It's, you know, it's Bob Mankoff, when he took over as editor, he was like, this art form is not going to survive unless we bring in more. So, you know, now, you know, under Bob, it was, you know, you started to see about 10 new people every year, whereas before I felt like it was like 10 new people every decade, you know. So that gave me my chance. And Matt sort of looked at my stuff and gave me feedback and said what Bob would hate and why. So he taught me how to do the weekly batches, 10 cartoons a week. And, you know, if you have the best week ever, you will sell one, you know, so they're probably all going to get rejected. Then they invited me to come to the Tuesday look meeting, you know, and that was the beginning of it for me.
What was the first one that was accepted of yours?
The first one, I really lucked out, because I sold for my first batch, which is really unusual. And it was right during the Iraq War. And it was a White House press secretary, and he's holding a flashlight under his face, like a kid, like a campsite. And the press person is saying, "How do you respond to critics who say you're just trying to scare people?" and so I really, you know, that I was not expecting to sell from my first batch. And so, you know, and I was off and running, and getting that validation from the New Yorker, you know, I was hooked.
I've interviewed a number of people who, you know, draw regular comic strips, and we've talked about, you know, sort of how far in advance they're submitted and how the editorial process works. But how does the process work for the New Yorker even after they've accepted a panel, which I gather has to be a lot more, you know, rapid turnaround than
yes.
what somebody drawing 3 months in advance for a strip
yes.
that's going to run in the newspaper will be?
Well, you know, sometimes they want it immediately. You know, and we're sending in roughs. We're sending in what's suggested is 10 roughs a week, different ideas. And sometimes they're topical and they want them right away. And sometimes some of them are supposed to be evergreen and timeless.
The How's Waldo one, for
right.
example.
Yeah, as long as Waldo's around, right. you know, that one might work. And so it all depends. And so I will do, you know, if Sometimes I'll take a week to get it in. Sometimes I'll have to turn it around overnight, you know.
And how much editorial guidance are you getting?
Yeah, you know, not that much. Especially when Bob was editor, and even now with Emma Allen as the new editor, he was a very big believer in letting us find our own voice and our own sensibility. And he thought that he would give us advice that was, you know, but his ethic was find your own voice, find your own way to do this. Which is great, but his advice would be sort of maddeningly vague because of that. Like, keep working on this, you know, keep working on the art. This is just okay, you know. It was a great mixture of encouragement and just, you know, you're like cold-hearted rejection at the same time.
Just kind of like life, really.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Bob Mankoff is a lot like life.
How often do you go to the Tuesday Look meetings?
You know, I haven't been in a while. I really went when Bob was sort of getting to know me and the magazine was getting to know me. And I think that's when it was important to go. And I could kind of feel him out and get a sense of what he liked that I was doing and what, you know. And he was sort of my champion there. He spotted something, you know, in my cartoons early on. And, like, he really encouraged me. But over time, you know, I start to wonder, you know, they like my cartoons. Me showing up in person, I could just mess it up, you know. So, you know, I began doing more just emailing, you know, after a while. But I drop in when I can and see, you know, it's a sort of, you know, a group of cartoonists there. It's a great sort of, it's great to complain with people who have to, you know, go through the same thing you do.
What sparked the move to middle grade fiction?
I was interested in doing something like that for a while. I grew up loving Roald Dahl. And I always kind of wanted, I was thinking like something along those lines. And, you know, I work a lot in notebooks and I kind of work stream of consciously. I'm not sure if something's going to be a single panel cartoon or an idea for an animated piece or an idea for something longer. And it was in a notebook, How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. And I forgot when I even wrote that. And I just, in front of it, I drew the kid counting money. And then I wrote the first line, which was, before you assume I'm a bad person, you should know that I had originally only planned on selling my grandma to the aliens, not my whole family. And I liked that voice, you know. And then it just sort of sat there. And then through my work in The New Yorker, I was contacted by an agent who said, do you have anything for middle graders? And I said, maybe. And so I just sort of picked that up again and wrote a couple chapters. And I sent it to her, and she became my agent and said, finish this. And, you know, and then she's sort of guided the process ever since.
And thus Hap Conklin Jr. was born.
Yes, exactly. That's the birth of Hap Conklin Jr.
There is something about an audience that reads a book and then rereads a book and then reads it a third time and a fourth time and then has their parents say, do you not have other books?
Yeah.
It's not like that with, I mean, you know, I might look at a New Yorker cartoon and find it funny and then show it to my wife who also finds it funny, but that's probably where I leave it.
Yes. Yeah, I think that, you know, there's something about that when a kid attaches to a story, you know, that becomes the story and they want to see it again and again and again. And I remember stories like that from when I was a kid and, you know, and it becomes very important. You know, and so that's why it's really, you know, seeing all these kids responding to the book really just blows my mind. You know?
I was going to ask about that because you probably don't get the same kind of feedback. You probably get a lot of complaining feedback sometimes on a New Yorker cartoon. But
yes.
You go to a school and they have devoured this book and
yes.
The feedback is a little different.
Yeah, that was, you know, and to see the kids welcoming me, I was in Chicago schools or Chicago area schools all last week, and I was welcomed with huge, amazing artwork of the characters, of, you know, of aliens, of, and they were, you know, and it was, it, that, that kind of blew my mind, you know, it was, it just to see them, you know, to see that it got their imagination going and them, and, you know, and they picked the, they pick right up on the humor, they pick right up on the characters. And, yeah, so that was fantastic.
What do you think they look for when you go to an event like that? What do they take from you?
I think that it's, it's a wide mix of students, you know, and everyone is different, you know, so it's a little bit of a new world for me because I'm kind of used to just sort of spinning this stuff off in my own mind and in my own studio. And then I'm in front of some schools, it's third through fifth, some schools it's just fifth, some like sixth graders, and it's all sort of wildly different. And, but, you know, I love that they are laughing. You know, that I think is key. I think about myself when I was that age when I'm writing this, and I think about, you know, when it started, I love science fiction. So I think about myself now, and I think about, you know, what I want to read now, but then I remind myself, hey, you know, 9-year-old Paul wants to read Mad Magazine, you know, and so then I kind of try to bring it back there, and so it's sort of just the mixture of that. And different kids are really responding to different things from the book.
When you think about cartooning and doing animation, which you have done, and writing middle grade fiction with illustrations as well, we should say, do they all occupy a slightly different place in your creative life? Do they scratch a slightly different creative itch for you?
I think so. Yes, it's and one of them, you know, lately I'm writing these books. It's a series of three books, and this is the first, and I'm finished the second, and I'm revising it, and I'm thinking about the third. And it is, I mean, writing stories has always been tremendously fun for me. And it's a sort of a different kind of manic energy. And all of a sudden, I just want to see what the characters are going to do. I want to see what's going to happen, you know? Single panel joke cartoons are fun, but they're difficult. You know, they're difficult in a different way because they're like a marathon versus a standing long jump, you know, like you just have to do it. And you give yourself some prompts, but it's really just, you know, it's really just you and that piece of paper, and you can't, you know, there's no characters to sort of build energy and have it sustain itself. But, you know, when you get it right, when you get a good one, you know, that's very addictive. That's really fun. So,
well, right. The thing that always strikes me about those single panel strips is that the really good ones, as you look at them, you can kind of, you know, it's incumbent on you to be able to figure out what has just happened before and what the result might be afterwards. You're kind of freezing this funny moment in time.
Yes, and I think the best ones kind of open up a world, you know, and they're surprising because you don't expect something that small to be funny and to resonate like that, you know. So it's because of the limitations of the form and the fact that people are just jumping into them and jumping out of them. You know, they're reading in the New Yorker, it could be they're reading something about, you know, China's economy, and then, you know, they're jumping into your, you know, you have two guys in a bar, and you know, that's the context, you know. So it's you know, they're very challenging, but they're extremely fun. And I've always been like a huge fan. You know, whenever I see a really good one, it just makes me happy in like a very particular way.
Well, Paul Noh, thank you so much for spending some time with us. And best of luck. Hope we'll see you again with book two.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Milwaukee native Paul Noh is a cartoonist whose work regularly appears in The New Yorker. His new book, however, is for middle grade readers. It's called How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. He was back in Wisconsin last month, and we first spoke with him then. That wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.